The Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee will come to order. Ms. Cheryl, please call the roll.
Chair Plasencia?
Here.
Vice Chair Mariano?
Here.
Representatives Greco?
Here.
Hawkins?
Here.
Joseph?
Here.
Manny? McCurdy?
Here.
Nixon?
Here.
Rizzo?
Here.
Rodriguez?
Here.
Rommel?
Here.
Schoaf?
Here.
Ranking Member Thompson?
Here.
Tuck?
Here.
Zika?
Present.
We have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
Quorum being present, I want to welcome everyone to the Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee. Please make sure that cell phones and other communication devices are turned off or on silent mode. Pursuant to House protocols, please wear a face mask, including while providing testimony. Members, today we will take up a consent agenda for appropriations project bills and hear two presentations, one from the Southern Regional Education Board on the impact of COVID accelerating changes in the workforce, and one from the Department of Education on workforce education and Florida College System initiatives to upskill Florida's workforce. Members, we are about to take up the consent agenda for appropriations project bills. We will take up the consent agenda and vote once on the agenda in its entirety. The public is welcome to testify on any of the bills listed on the consent agenda. Members, we will not take up question, debate, and vote on each of the bills individually. Instead, we will be in questions and debate only once. Remember, you may vote no on any particular bill by submitting a nay vote consent agenda form with the administrative assistant before the vote. Please keep in mind that passing these bills makes these projects eligible for funding, but does not guarantee that these projects will be funded or funded at the requested level. With that said, are there any questions? Is there any public testimony? We have Alejandro Gonzalez, United Way of Broward County. Is Mr. Gonzalez in attendance? They are not, but they wish to waive in support. We have Sam Wagner with the American Legion Auxiliary Department of Florida, wishing to waive in support as well. Okay. Is there any debate, members? Before I call the vote on the consent agenda, are there any nay vote forms? Administrative assistant, will you please call the roll on the consent agenda? Remember, a yes vote signifies an affirmative vote for every bill on the consent agenda, with the exception of any no votes on the particular bill that were just announced.
Chair Plasencia?
Yes.
Vice Chair Mariano? Representatives Greco?
Yes.
Hawkins?
Yes.
Joseph?
Yes.
Manny?
Yes.
McCurdy?
Yes.
Nixon?
Yes.
Rizzo?
Yes.
Rodriguez?
Yes.
Rommel?
Yes.
Schoaf?
Yes.
Ranking Member Thompson?
Yes.
Tuck?
Yes.
Zika? 15 yeas, 0 nays, sir.
Show the consent agenda passes. All of the bills on the consent agenda will be reported favorably. Members will now be hearing from Dr. Stephen Pruitt. He is the president of the Southern Regional Education Board and will present on the impact of COVID accelerating changes in the workforce via WebEx. Members, please turn your attention to the screens. And Dr. Pruitt, it is great to see you and you are recognized, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's great to be seen in Florida. I would much rather be in Florida, but unfortunately we're just not quite to that point yet. So it is great to be with you all, committee. Thank you for having us. I'm going to share with you a little bit today about what's going on with the impact of COVID on our workforce. We've certainly seen a lot. We've certainly seen things that have impacted our economy, but what we may not have seen completely are some of the things that are just under the surface. So first, I just very quickly like to remind everyone, the Southern Regional Education Board is an interstate compact that Florida is actually a charter member of. The 16 states that comprise the compact, what we do is we actually provide three very specific purposes. We analyze and publish information, whether it be data or research. We convene and engage decision makers in education, government, business to discuss that, and then we support action in the states. So our role literally is to support you. So I would just simply say on the front end that we are happy to be in our 73rd year of supporting Florida, and we hope that you guys will call on us at any point to be able to, for us to provide any information you may need. Well, what I'd like to do is begin by giving you a couple of issues of why we've got to really pay attention to this. First of all, by 2030, for the first time in our nation's history, we're going to have more age-dependent people than we actually do working age. So that means people under 25 and over 65. So in Florida, it's actually a little bit higher than it is in most places. In the region itself, we're looking at roughly 53 dependent people for every 47. In Florida, we have 55 age-dependent individuals that are going to be needed to be supported by just 45 working age adults. Now, what that means is that's not disability. This is purely based on age. And also what this means is that we're going to need to make sure that all of the adults that we have who are working age have the ability to be employed and have the ability to be active members of our economy. I think you have actually seen this before. One of my colleagues presented this to you in the past. But our work is based on our Unprepared and Unaware report and our economic outlook, in which we predict that by 2030, we may see as many as 18 million unemployable adults. But that was before COVID, and you'll see what I'm talking about a little bit more here in just a moment. Now, what we found in those reports is that actually the people who have the lowest educational attainment are the ones that are most vulnerable in a recession, and certainly in a pandemic. So in Florida, we see the latest data that we have is in 2017, and we see that 11% have less than high school education, 28% have high school equivalency or high school diplomas or equivalency. So you've got a significant number of people who could potentially be impacted here. In Florida, when we did our initial review of the workforce there, that 18 million that I talked about earlier, Florida's contribution to that is 3 million. So when we look at that, we look at the possibility of looking at those people who have the lowest education attainment, the types of jobs, the low-skill, low-paying jobs that are available in Florida. And in working with our various sources, what we found was that there are roughly 3 million individuals that could potentially be unemployable. Now, again, I want to emphasize, this is unemployable, not unemployed. That means that they don't have the skills or wouldn't have the skills necessary to be active participants in the workforce. Now, pre-pandemic, what we looked at was what was going to be the impact of automation and artificial intelligence on the workforce. All of these reports we're doing are looking specifically at how this is going to play such a bigger role. Now, folks, I know that we've been talking about robots and everything for a long time. I mean, we all grew up watching the Jetsons. But the reality is that this curve is now here. The reality is that what we see industry doing is moving to a greater reliance, greater dependence even, on automation and on artificial intelligence. So pre-pandemic, we were predicting that by 2030, we may see as much as 68% of food preparation and serving, for instance, being automated, 43% of sales, 64% of office and administrative, 32% of healthcare, and 63% transportation. Now, the reality is that the pandemic has exacerbated this. It has actually created a greater problem than what we ever thought. So the workers that are most vulnerable to this automation are also those that have the greatest risk for work disruptions during this pandemic. So again, it's those with the lowest levels of education. We have seen where women and people of color have left the workforce and not come back. And we see workers that are ages 16 to 23 and ages 56 to 74, they have actually been majorly impacted by the reliance of industry on automation. Now in Florida specifically, 4 million workers, 45% of that workforce are at risk for unemployment based on what we have seen by the impact of COVID. Now 17% are considered essential, 33% of the workers can continue to work from home. But you know, those folks are less likely to be out of work because of the pandemic. But there's a significant amount of population in Florida that is potentially subject to this, in so much as not only did they lose their jobs during the pandemic, those jobs simply aren't there when they come back. Now, this is the scary part. The pandemic itself, in our work and in our review of McKinsey Global and other really quality resources, we thought that 2030 was a horizon. We thought that was going to be the place that we were going to see this significant shift into automation and artificial intelligence. But the pandemic actually advanced the consumer business digital adoption by an estimated 5 years in just 8 weeks. In other words, where we thought we had to 2030, we thought we had this great horizon of 10 years to get some things in place. What we actually found is this is the next exit. If we're on the interstate, we're no longer looking at a horizon. This is had such a significant impact over this time that we're actually looking at the next exit. What this means for us, ladies and gentlemen, is that when we think about what industry had to do during the pandemic, they couldn't stop. You know, during a recession or during a pandemic, industry keeps moving. So they had to find ways to do it. And it accelerated what we already knew was going to happen with automation, but it accelerated by 5 years in just 8 weeks. So when we think about this, and this is from the 2019 labor statistics. Now, the way our methodology on this is we looked at what the data we had, a lot of it pre-pandemic. We looked at it through the lens of the work of organizations like McKinsey Global and the impact that they saw based on their review of industry. So prior to the pandemic, 1.3 million workers were officially unemployed. 635,000 more were likely to be out of work or left the labor force. Now, of those, 1.1 million are highly unlikely to be called back to work. In fact, what you'll see is if you look at the last Great Recession, we saw that individuals who had some school past high school, some education past high school, or bachelor's degrees, saw a net increase in the number of jobs and the number of individuals that were called back to work. Those who had high school diplomas or less, they actually saw a significant decrease. In fact, only 80,000 individuals got their jobs back after the end of the Great Recession if they had a high school diploma or less. Now, what does this do to Florida? When you look at roughly one-third of the workforce in Florida, in the next 5 years, these five industries, your top industries, have been so subjected and so dependent now on automation that we're going to see 21% of automation in healthcare, 45% preparation in food preparation and serving, 28% in sales and related, office administration 43%, in transportation and material moving up to 42%. Now you may go, well, those numbers don't look too bad. They're pretty bad. Those represent people. Those represent individuals who will simply be out of work. Now, here's the thing, I want to be clear. We're not saying the old adage that robots are going to kick individuals out of workplace. What it's doing is it's creating a better workplace, but it means that they're going to have to be higher skilled. It means that they're going to have a higher level of education. It means that we can't count on people to just simply come out of high school and hope they get a job. Those jobs are going to be far more scarce. So there's got to be an additional effort to be able to push a real plan and a real initiative to get people upskilled and get them back into the workforce. Now, I will share with you, Florida's got some great things going on. In fact, we actually had Chancellor Mack and Chancellor Hepta on a webinar to share with all across the country the work that's going on around their Rapid Credential Grant Program. We're really appreciative of them being a part of that. And Florida is doing a really, really nice job of having a focus and a vision for this. Now, I say that because what's going to be important, and I believe this is where legislative leadership is going to be critical, just as we talk about with gubernatorial leadership, and that is working toward a unified vision for the workforce. Nibbling around the edges or thinking about just K-12 or just post-secondary or just workforce will not help us in the grander scheme of things. We're going to have to do this in a way that actually expands, that actually has a focus, and that as Floridians, you have a goal of where you want your workforce to be by the year 2025 and subsequent 2030. Well, how do we do that? Well, you've got some things, but the biggest number one thing is set a North Star. Having a group that comes together that helps identify what do we want our workforce to look like. Preparing and educating a skilled workforce has to come together with our K-12 individuals as we think about the Every Student Succeeds Act and how they are able to be ready in English, math, high school graduation rate, English proficiency, and science. Science is important because of, and math are particularly important in a world of automation and artificial intelligence. Bringing together the work and the funds that come to us through Perkins and through WIOA, the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act, and meeting the skilled workforce needs of employers. When those three things come together, we've got to think about the goals aligning to a vision. If we think about them separately, there won't be progress. But if we think about them together, we have great opportunity. Three ways that you can think of doing this from recommendations that we have developed in our research and work with different folks around the region. First of all, is having a good quality career pathway, sharing labor data, targeting, and by the way, I'll give Florida also kudos for this, that their K-12 system in particular, their post-secondary system have great data. The workforce has great data as well, but they don't all necessarily talk to one another. I'm the former commissioner of education in Kentucky. We had an opportunity there with having a single hub that collected all of the data from preschool all the way through K-12, through post-secondary, through the workforce. And in doing that, we were able to make good decisions, good policy decisions, because we knew not just what our top five industries in the state were, we knew what the top five in each of eight regions that were roughly 30-mile radius. So having that shared set of data is important. And then developing career pathways that help move students along to credentials of value. And I think you'll probably hear some of that coming up in a little bit when Chancellor Mack comes up. Work-based learning is critical. One of the biggest things that we hear from industry over and over again is we need people with experience. That means that we've got to find better ways to get people into these opportunities at the high school level and after. But it also means that we have to be creative about removing barriers and actually incentivizing people to be a part of it. And finally, equity, that we have to think about how to collaborate on these things together. This can't be the work of a single agency or a single arm of the government. It actually has to be a branch of the government. This is something that's going to really have to be a coordination of support services and engaging shareholders together. Now, you see the word shareholders there. That's a term I use, not financial shareholders, but these are people who, because they've been at the table, they are willing to invest their time to help find solutions to the problems. So recently, we started a commission or we completed a commission on work-based learning recommendations. I'm going to quickly run through these. First of all, our recommendation on process was to engage business and industry leaders in forging and strengthening regional and sector partnerships in the support of career education. We've seen some people that have done a really incredible job of this. When we think about aligning this work, some of the most robust partnerships with industry are out in Colorado. We see where Alabama and Delaware in our own region have had a real focus on engaging and strengthening those relationships. Prioritizing state resources and efforts to develop career pathways in critical industry sectors is a big deal. Utilizing things like the Workforce Innovation Boards. In Kentucky, we would use the administrative money from Perkins. And rather than divide it up by a formula, we met as a group with industry and we decided what the priorities of the state were going to be based on the data that I mentioned earlier. And that's where the funding went. Probably one of the most difficult meetings I had every year. Nothing compared to a budget meeting that you guys have. But it was tough, but it also meant that we were funding the priorities that we had. We've got to create supportive policies, adopting a business-friendly statewide policy for K-16 and work-based learning that promotes a continuum of experiences beginning in middle school and extending through post-secondary. That means counseling. That means giving students opportunities, incentivizing them in the accountability systems to get into those, into apprenticeships and work-based learning opportunities. Thinking about how to provide a policy solution for workman's comp. A lot of industry says, we can't have students that age in our workplace. In Kentucky, we did a statewide contract with ADECO. And ADECO would hire our students and place them into these industries where they would take on the workman's comp and liability insurance so that industry didn't have to worry about it. That's what ADECO does. But because of that, we were able to get more students placed into some of these critical high-need areas. Funding, obviously aligning the priorities, but also thinking about how to braid the funding from multiple sources, federal, state, local, private, and philanthropic. Providing incentives to employers that offer paid work-based learning experiences. We've seen this in Delaware and South Carolina. And finally, the tools and mechanisms. Promoting a simulated workplace. West Virginia has an incredible program where they actually provide a simulated workplace for students to go ahead and get that experience while they're in school. And then designating a state agency or a special counsel to work with employers and secondary and post-secondary education agencies to identify, evaluate, and approve industry certification exams, technical skills, dual enrollment courses, and end-of-course assessments that are part of stackable credentials. In other words, we have to rethink how we're doing a lot of career and technical education. We have to rethink how, and now when I say that, I don't necessarily mean Florida, I mean in general. We have to have credentials of value that are going to get people to these higher level jobs and higher paying jobs. This is my contact information. I am more than happy to take questions from the committee. We, as I said, are excited about helping and supporting you. I like to say all the time that what SREB really is about is we are about finding unique solutions to common challenges. And so in doing that, we want Florida to do what's going to be best for Florida, but we bring to you and we submit to you these findings that we have as issues, as things that are rooted in data and research for you to consider so that as you go through this legislative session, as you go through the work of Florida, that you can make the best decisions possible. But I will tell you that we are in a place, in a time, that time is of the essence. We are no longer necessarily planting the proverbial seed of the tree whose shade will never sit under. In fact, if we're not careful, we're actually going to see where the next few years will just go up in a flash. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will be happy to turn it back over to you and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Pruitt. Members, are there any questions for Dr. Pruitt? Dr. Pruitt, I do have a question. So I've seen some data recently on migratory patterns for Americans who are moving out of certain cities, usually urban areas, and to other parts of the country. For our benefit, Florida has received a great many of those people that are moving out of their state and into our state. Have you taken a look at any data and how that impacts workforce in our states as well?
We've begun to look at some of that. We've not gone deeply into that because, to be honest with you, we don't necessarily have all of the data that we need to be able to do that in all of our states. Again, some of our states have better data systems where they can follow the individuals than others. We see a lot of people that are not necessarily moving, but they move across state lines. In other words, they live in one state, come across the state line because there is a better workforce there. We are still seeing where rural areas are frankly, they're drying up. And for people to be able to find work, they're having to move to either more urban areas or to areas where we see greater potential for work. So an example would be in Columbus, Georgia, which is a fairly rural area. Kia started a manufacturing plant there. We've seen a great deal of individuals who have moved to the area of Columbus, Georgia. And the same thing can be said in Alabama. And certainly Florida, across the whole state, you've seen a boom in different industries. But it really does boil down to, what are you offering people to be able to make a living wage? And I think there's a lot of benefit to what Florida's already doing. But again, I think that the key is going to be, how do you continue to have those industry-friendly policies that allow people, or allow industry to come in, knowing that they have an educated workforce to be able to take those roles.
Thank you, Dr. Pruitt, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Members, next, the Department of Education will present Workforce Education and Florida College System initiatives to upskill Florida's workforce. Kathy Hebda, Chancellor of the Florida College System, and Henry Mack, Chancellor of the Division of Career and Adult Education, will be presenting on behalf of the department. Chancellor Hebda, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon, Chair and members. It's a pleasure for Chancellor Mack and I to be here. Opportunity to talk about Florida's college system and the workforce initiatives across the state. First thing we'll touch on a little bit.
Chancellor, is your mic on?
Oh, good question.
Tap it a couple times, see what it does.
Is it on now?
I don't know. Tap on the microphone itself. It is on. Okay. Thank you.
How about that? Is that better? I just need to adjust it. Thank you. So we'll start with attainment. This was mentioned by Dr. Pruitt in his presentation, and I know it's an important aspect for Florida. In looking at where Florida ranks in attainment, we are currently 20th state in the nation in educational attainment beyond high school for working age adults, that's age 25 to 64, and we're just above the national average as a state. That doesn't mean every city and county has the same level of attainment, but that is the state average. Why do we care about rankings like that for attainment? Because behind those rankings are Floridians, individuals, families, students, who may or may not have a credential of value, something valuable that can help them enter the world of work and move up in the world of work and provide for themselves and their families. So attainment of credentials also means economic security and growth for the state of Florida. On this slide, we've referenced a number of national data points. You all are familiar with the Chamber's 2030 report, and you certainly heard Dr. Pruitt just talk about the growth and the immediate growth, practically, that we're having now in the need for employment and specific kinds of jobs that are different than perhaps just a few years ago. So what are the major initiatives that are going on in the state that address this attainment gap? Certainly you see three big ones here. Certainly the governor in his executive order in 2019, Order 1931, You'll hear Chancellor Mack talk about this a little more when he talks about some specific initiatives, laid out a course for Florida to be the number one state in workforce education by 2030. It refers to an audit that's been going on that Chancellor Mack will talk about, and a number of strategies that executive order expected us to complete to address the gap. Certainly, House Bill 7071 in 2019, and Vice Chair Mariano was a co-sponsor of that legislation, laid out the Sail to 60 initiative, also targeting strategies that would increase educational attainment of high-value credentials. And then last, we have the ongoing State Board of Education strategic plan. Every 5 years, the State Board looks at their plan, and there are a number of metrics in that plan that the State Board tracks, even on a further level down than the levels of the governor's office and the legislature, to ensure students are achieving milestones in K through 20. There's seamless articulation and access for all Floridians into post-secondary education, and that we are producing the highest skilled workforce and economic development. So how do we address these major directives? Well, our theory of action is quite simple. Target the gaps. Where are the gaps in attainment? Where are the gaps in skills and degrees and credentials that our workforce, the businesses, and others in Florida are looking for? Implementing those strategies that will target the gaps is our approach. So that brings me to the college system, because the mission and the purpose of the college system and career and technical education as they're laid out in Florida statutes applies directly to this goal, an increased attainment and economic self-sufficiency for all Floridians. You'll note that to provide access, real access in our institutions, Florida College System institutions focus on providing the highest quality education, but affordably and with flexibility. In 2015, for example, the average cost of 1 year or 30 credit hours of credit in tuition and fees from the FCS was $3,202. In 2019, it was $3,209, practically the same. Leadership in the state and FCS institutions have really focused on keeping college affordable, keeping tuition low, keeping fees low, and affordability is certainly a really important aspect of access for all Floridians. So who are we serve? Who are these Floridians that are in the college system? And we included data for technical centers, too. They're operated by school districts here because we're talking about workforce education today. And there are certainly pathways from tech centers into Florida College System institutions. So you can see that combined, we serve over 800,000 students. That's our headcount. You'll also notice that nearly two-thirds of the students in the Florida College System are part-time students. They're working themselves through school, they have families, children, they're taking care of their parents, they're doing all of that while they're trying to earn their education. You can see the average ages as well for part-time and full-time students. St. Pete College, for example, has an average age of their whole student population of 27 years. So we have a lot of returning adults that come back to school, come back to upskill and reskill through the Florida College System. You can also see by the numbers that workforce education in Florida is very military friendly. So what about the outcomes for all of the folks that are enrolled? So we have the kinds of programs we have in the Florida College System. Of those 715,000 individuals who are enrolled, about 213,000 or more are enrolled in what you would call specifically workforce degree or certificate programs. And then you have individuals who have actually earned a workforce degree of 64,000 plus, industry certifications. And then the other thing that's really important about the college system is that so many of our graduates, you see there, 93% stay in Florida to live and work. That's the great part of our college system being regional colleges and being responsible for districts in the state, is that's who they serve. That is their responsibility, it's their statutory mission. And that's what they do every single day. Now, I added the statistic on the bottom left, even though you wouldn't think of this as a workforce statistic. I put that there because noting that 43% of the state university system juniors and seniors are transferred from the FCS means that the AA degree can also be thought of as the bridge into a workforce baccalaureate or other degree from the university system. Many of our students, because of who I described and who we serve, they enter the enter post-secondary education through their local college. That's their gateway into the university system. In fact, 61% last year of the Florida high school graduating seniors who stayed in Florida for post-secondary went into post-secondary through the Florida college system. So we remain the primary access to post-secondary. In fact, I will tell you that we awarded 58,421 AA degrees last year in the Florida college system. 2,000 of those were actually awarded to high school seniors who were getting their high school diploma at the same time, thanks to our fantastic dual enrollment system. So another way that we provide access locally to students and families in Florida is through dual enrollment. Last year, in 2019-20, we had about 80% of the dual enrollment that happens in Florida happens in the FCS, and over 82,000 students participated in dual enrollment, mostly public school students, but also private school students and home education students. That translates into over 900,000 credits that were earned. And if you just think of that, and also clock hours, over 100,000 clock hours were earned in clock hour career programs through dual enrollment. If you just think of that, multiplying it by the standard rate of tuition that's in the statute, we've saved Florida families over $72 million last year just through dual enrollment. It's a big number. So what have colleges been doing? What are some of the initiatives and things that they've been doing for their students and their communities during the pandemic recovery specifically? We know what their core mission is. We know they do workforce. We know they do AA programs. We know the students they serve with their mission and outreach. What are some of the things that they've been doing? Well, for communities, we'll start there. The Florida College System institutions are a major provider of first responders, law enforcement, EMTs, and certainly a major provider of other medical professionals, nurses, CNAs, et cetera. Respiratory therapists, there are a number of individuals in the medical fields that the colleges provide, and they kept those programs going during the pandemic. As difficult as it was, implementing CDC guidelines, doing everything they needed to do, they kept those programs going and produced those individuals that were so critical to Florida's neighborhoods and communities. Additionally, for their communities, they donated PPE, they used their 3D printers to print things that hospitals needed. They donated ventilators from their nursing programs. In fact, they even, at the request of many of the hospitals, allowed their nurses who were doing clinicals at the hospitals to continue during the pandemic at the hospital's request so they could help with any of the situations that were coming up with COVID and the other patients who were in the hospitals. They served as testing sites for COVID testing. That's still happening. And in fact, now we even have 8 colleges that are serving as vaccination sites for COVID. The other thing that they did that I should touch on that also is an ongoing way that they serve their students and a much needed way they serve their students is providing wraparound services. So they have food pantries, they have extra tutoring and advising, and a lot of those things that their students need, certainly financial aid services. And then during the pandemic, they increased their partnerships to provide food and deal with food insecurities for students and their families. They provided free Wi-Fi, provided things, laptops for students, anything that they could do to keep students learning and focused. So in talking about students, I know that one of the things, Mr. Chair, you wanted us to touch on was the counter-cyclical way that college enrollment works, kind of in opposition to the health of the economy. So when you look at this slide, what this shows you is our FTE, our full-time equivalent, which when we have about 715,000 individual students, our FTE is just over 300,000 because so many are part-time. But those numbers are here graphed against unemployment numbers. And so as the economy gets better, then usually enrollment in the college system drops. You can see the biggest peak there is the Great Recession from a few years ago. And then you can see the little dip where we're currently in the year 2021, and that's the rise in unemployment on the bottom and the dip in enrollment that you see estimated for this year in the college system. That shows you that this recession is a little bit different than the Great Recession, where you can see we had incredible increases in enrollment when the economy was down for a number of years in a row. So what does that mean for the college system? What is causing that dip in enrollment when typically during a recession, it would have skyrocketed? It's the cause of the pandemic. There are a number of individual students, when presidents talk about this, and this is no different in the college system here in Florida than across the country, there are a number of students that we serve that just can't do post-secondary education while they're trying to do the rest of their life. They have families, they have children, they're taking care of parents. Their job moved online, their children's education moved online for a while. And that struggle for many of them, personally, they said, was just too much to keep going to post-secondary right now. So they're not back yet. I say yet, because colleges are still working on bringing them back. And but for the efforts of the colleges to reach out constantly, over and over again, personally, to those students and their residents, we would have more people who had a struggle with post-secondary education and would not have enrolled. So in some cases, even though we are missing some of our full-time, first-time in college students, I should say, just like many other schools are across the nation, there are bright spots. We are doing a little better with those students in Florida than other community colleges or state colleges in other parts of the country. We've also, because of the efforts of the colleges, been able to start to see, and you can see the dotted lines there, that the estimating conference last December is still projecting that we will start to see an increase very soon. And that's because of the efforts of the colleges and what they've been doing. I will, before I pass it to Chancellor Mack, I will talk just for a second about a conversation I had with Bob Ward a couple of weeks ago from the Council of 100. He was saying that he had done a set of interviews with the CEOs across Florida and about workforce education. And are you being supplied with what you need? And how's it going? Tell me about this. And he said that to a person, every CEO he spoke with mentioned the Florida college system and how they were supplying what they needed, how they were always flexible. They were always not just willing to help, but one CEO even described them as hungry to help and do anything that was needed to help provide what they needed at their business. So I say that because one of the ways to get through this, we talk about resilience of our students, resilience of our system, resilience of our citizens in the pandemic, and that kind of resilience and that kind of stick with it and don't let anybody drop attitude is what's keeping the college system and their students thriving and moving forward during the pandemic. And now I'm gonna change it to Chancellor Mack?
Chancellor Hebda, if you don't mind, I think we're going to want to ask questions now, so that way you don't have to come back and forth.
Absolutely.
And thank you for your presentation, by the way. Members, are there any questions for Chancellor Hebda? Representative Schoaf, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chancellor. That was a very informative presentation. I noticed in the slide that's still up, it's talking about the college system. Does DOE or do you track similar numbers with the technical schools as far as enrollment versus the unemployment rate?
We can do that. I know we have the enrollment for the technical colleges. I don't know that we've graphed it this way exactly, but we certainly could.
Would you be able to provide an educated guess? Does it follow a similar trajectory or is it completely different?
You know, I don't know, Chancellor Mack. I don't know if you know the answer to that.
And Chancellor Mack, you're welcome to come up and answer questions if you need to.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. Great question. Yes, historically, sort of the trends are the same. With the technical centers, however, the programs are much shorter in duration. So typically we see trends not as drastic or a drop relative to recession trends in the economy as we do in the Florida college system, principally because of the short-term nature of the programs themselves. Typically, they get in, they get out, and that's in some ways a much more attractive proposition to many. But I would be happy to provide a follow-up with the details so you could sort of juxtapose that against the trends here.
Mr. Chair, can I just add one thing to that, too? It's pertaining to the Florida college system, but I wanted to make sure that I said this. These are system numbers, and every single college doesn't track exactly the same way as every other college, even within the college system. The presidents have told me in talking with them throughout this year that it's almost like they have 28 microeconomies, one for each college. Gulf Coast State College, for example, in Panama City, their economy right now is driven much more by recovery from Hurricane Michael and the need for workers than it is necessarily by pandemic recovery. Valencia College and Seminole State are right there in Orlando, where they have some of the fastest growing neighborhoods in the nation. So different places in the state are experiencing this in different ways. And so not everyone, for example, Valencia College even expects to be a little bit ahead of where they were last year in enrollment because of some of those things.
And just to piggyback off what Chancellor Hebdes just said, I was looking at the numbers, and I think it's right around 4 of our state colleges have an increase or a projected increase in enrollment. So she's right. Not all of them are seeing a decrease. Some of them have seen an increase as well. Representative Rizzo, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chancellor. I have a couple of questions, Chair, if you'll indulge me. Thank you. Chair, when you began your presentation, you said that Florida ranked 20th in state's credential attainment. Why is that? What can you attribute that to? Why are we not in the top 5?
Mr. Chair.
Chancellor Hebda, I appreciate you going through the chair. In my committee, you don't have to. You're more than welcome to have a dialogue with a member, but I appreciate and respect that.
Thank you, sir. Attainment is more than just how many completers do we have from our universities, colleges, and technical centers, including ICUF and all the other institutions. Attainment is just who in the state, how many of your residents hold one of those credentials. So it can also be affected by in-migration and out-migration if people are coming to the state. Like Dr. Pruitt talked about, if a new business is set up and they need a lot of engineers, you may have a lot of people move to the state that already have an engineering degree. And that will affect the state's attainment rate. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so I was wondering if immigration had anything to do with that, you know, in and out of the state or into the state, actually, if that might be it. That why we're kind of midway, you know, of the 50 and not, you know, in the top 10, top 5 or something like that.
It could be a contributing factor, people moving in and out. And Dr. Pruitt even mentioned the people that don't actually move here, but they come across the border to work only. And so, for example, the colleges up in the top part of the state, in this part of the state, you know, a lot of folks that live in South Georgia or Alabama and then come here to work during the day. So if they hold a credential, Georgia gets that credit.
Okay.
And we don't.
My next two questions actually referred to slides 7 and 8. What articulation, if any, does the Florida college system have with the school systems, with the technical centers? Because, 90,000 versus 715,000, I'm just wondering, is there, a strong articulation amongst the LEAs?
Thank you. Yes, there absolutely is. And the Office of Articulation is actually in Chancellor Mack's division. There are articulation agreements specifically for workforce programs where clock hour courses that are taken, for example, let's say I go to Lively Tech here in town and I take welding courses. Those clock hour courses are not college credit, but they can be converted or they can articulate into college credit if I want to continue my education then at TCC mm-hmm. and use those welding credits to go to the next level. Mm-hmm. So there are definitely agreements. That way there are statewide agreements for certain courses. The easiest pathway we have is nursing, mm-hmm. the LPN to RN to BSN. Everyone across the state uses that pathway. And so your previous credits then articulate to the next level so you don't repeat those courses.
Right. And my last question was, do you know how many of the, you know, currently 90,000 as of last the data set that you put up there, of the students are actually enrolling in the college system, in the Florida college system? Are they going somewhere else? Are they doing something else afterwards? Or is it a direct correlation, you know, where almost every single one of the 90,000 are articulating straight into the Florida college system?
Thank you. That's a great question. It's interesting because one of the reasons I put the, on the, I guess the next slide, was the 43% of the juniors and seniors have come from the college system, because the AA degree is considered a transfer degree. Although there are certainly some certain positions where an AA would be required and that's the last degree you need, it's considered a transfer degree. It's your stepping stone into university and to a baccalaureate program. That's not necessarily how we think of many workforce programs. Chancellor Mack just mentioned some of the short-term programs where you go get that credential and it is for the job you're going to go into, so you go to work right then. Now, what we're working on, and we need to keep working on, are those on-ramps back in. Like even the rapid credentialing program that Chancellor Mack's going to talk about, part of it is to absolutely get people to work right now who are displaced by the pandemic with better skills and a better job. That may also, for those individuals, be their hook into higher education so that they come back and they continue to upskill and stack those credentials on top of each other.
And that was something I wanted to ask you. Is stackability, you know, a major factor in what you're talking about?
Absolutely, 100%. That's exactly right.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Any other questions? Chancellor Hebda, I do have a couple questions. So when we're talking about workers upskilling, how much of that can or is done online?
That depends on the program that you're in. There are a number of programs now that are exclusively online, and colleges certainly learned a lot about, like everybody else did, about how to improve, and they invested in improvements in remote education. And that's so much different in so many cases now than it was pre-pandemic. It's not just a notebook online and you go do your work and come back. There's so much more interaction and curriculum design and everything else that's gone on to make those programs really viable and preferable for some students going forward, because there's certainly conveniences with those kinds of programs. At this point in time, the system average is about, for all of their courses, the modality is about 62-63% remote, and the opposite is online. Or face-to-face, excuse me, which includes full-time face-to-face and hybrid face-to-face, where you spend part of the time in the classroom and part of the time doing work remotely. Some institutions are back to the exact same percentage they were pre-pandemic, which is about 75-25 face-to-face and remote. Others are taking longer, and they're finding their way there. And so the system average is not necessarily indicative of where any specific college is.
And do you see maybe a trend moving forward that there's going to be a greater emphasis placed on online upskilling?
Sorry, yes, there actually was before the pandemic. Colleges were being encouraged to do more online or remote kinds of learning activities. But just like Dr. Pruitt said, that increase happened overnight practically. Colleges went to remote. They provided all their services remotely too. Typically, student financial aid is not an online service. It is now. And that's increased the convenience for students and the ability to reach more students, too. So I don't know whether we'll get back to the exact same percentage as the system that we were. There probably will be more online and remote options, but those remote options now will be of higher quality than they were in the past. And colleges take very great care to make sure that even when they're doing a hybrid type of course, what is the most important thing to do face-to-face and what are the best things to do remotely?
And my last question is, what do you know the percentage or if there is also a trend in online dual enrollment?
I don't know the answer to the trend. Certainly there would have been more online dual enrollment during the pandemic because everybody went remote for a while. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you, our dual enrollment numbers still increased this fall over last fall, which is great. Mm-hmm. We're very excited about that. So we'll go check and see what the numbers exactly are in dual enrollment online. If we can find that out, it might be a little hard to tease out, but we'll see what we can do and bring that information back to you.
Okay. Thank you so much, Chancellor.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Chancellor Mack, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to be sensitive to time. May I inquire how much we have left?
We have another hour, so you can tell us stories.
Okay, like. Great. Wonderful. Very thankful to be with you this afternoon to talk generally about workforce education or career and technical education. As chancellor for CTE for the state of Florida, I help oversee the college system's sub-baccalaureate programs, so everything below baccalaureate, the AS degrees principally, as well as the clock hour, as well as the CCCs or the college credit certificates, in addition to the technical centers throughout our school districts, as well as K-12 CTE and adult ed and apprenticeship and articulation. Very exciting time for CTE and very, very appreciative for your invitation to speak very quickly about some initiatives we have going on across the education system itself. For context and to sort of maybe level set, I kind of want to provide just a quick overview of how things are funded and structured in the state of Florida, at least with respect to workforce education and career and technical education. Principal funding sources us outside of tuition and fees from the state include the State Workforce Development Fund. Roughly about $370 million flow down into the districts to support the work of our technical centers across the state of Florida. That $370 million is not just for career and technical education, however, it is also supportive of our adult education programs, our adult basic ed, high school equivalency, integrated education and training programs across our school districts. The Florida College System Program Fund also includes support for career and technical education, workforce education programs across the college system at the sub-baccalaureate level as well as baccalaureate, in addition to those colleges that are adult ed providers and offering apprenticeship programs. We have state industry certification performance funding, roughly at about $20 million or so, to incent enrollment and completion in in-demand industry certifications. These are third-party credentials that are endorsed by a third party that are aligned to market demand. Principally, I'm referring to the CAPE list and the CAPE Act itself. Our federal support comes from WIOA, the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act Title II, as well as the apprenticeship funds that the governor, and thankfully to you as well, have allocated toward the support of registered apprenticeship, scaling and growing apprenticeship across the state of Florida. That's $10 million in state funds, and we currently have about a $3 million grant from the feds to help do the same. And the preeminent federal investment that we get every year from the from the U.S. Department of Education is Perkins 5. Perkins 5 was renewed under President Trump in 2018, and we developed a new state plan for Florida, which sort of sets a course for career and technical education, piggybacking on the leadership of Governor DeSantis in Executive Order 1931 to become number one in workforce education by 2030. Really representative to get that number from 20 to 1, at least according to Lumina, which is an exciting initiative. As Chancellor Hebda sort of alluded to, the workforce and career and technical education credentialing types that we offer are many and varied, some longer, some shorter. Many people are unaware of additional opportunities for upskilling or reskilling outside of the traditional Associate of Science program or outside the traditional college credit course. We have applied technology diplomas as well as short-term career certificate opportunities for students, as well as apprenticeship and pre-apprenticeship programs across the state of Florida, which are excellent, excellent earn while you learn educational opportunities for students so that they are employed, guaranteed certain wage progressions and income, but also have the ability to port that apprenticeship experience to a college credit program to get a post-secondary credential, in addition to licensure and industry certification. This has brought all of us to really this point, and what I want to sort of present on today or spend the majority of my time discussing is the Rapid Credentialing Grant Program. As Dr. Pruitt mentioned and as Chancellor Hebda mentioned, the nimbleness and the flexibility of our post-secondary education system is bar none, I think, best in class. We have pivoted and we have engaged many residents who are subject not only to automation, but as a result of the pandemic and the kind of employment that they enjoyed prior to the pandemic, found themselves in need of immediate upskilling and reskilling. And so very early on, the commissioner and the governor set aside $35 million to incent enrollment and completion in short-term but high-value credentialing programs across the state of Florida. And the response has been, again, phenomenal. To date, we have credentialed more than this number is a little low at this point, since these numbers are changing every week, since these short-term programs are designed actually from 2 weeks to 20 weeks in length. We're at about now about 6,000 students who have earned at least one short-term credential, as well as roughly maybe 68% of those finding themselves in employment as a result of this initiative. The unanticipated happy consequence of this is that we saw private industry ponying up, supporting students through additional grant funds, through Florida Power and Light, $1 million for laptops, Gulf Power Foundation, the Schultz, my favorite one of them all, Metallica, kicking in $100,000 to support scholarships in students, or rather for students, enjoying or rather needing a short-term but high-value certification program to, again, find themselves either employable or needing to upskill in their current employment so as to not be as susceptible to unemployment or being furloughed as a result of the pandemic. And I appreciate SREB's guidance here throughout. It is worth noting to the representative's question that we did not want to incent completion in dead-end credentials. That is, credentialing opportunities or training programs that could not stack into a higher degree. And this is the needle, I think, that needs to be threaded. Despite the greatness around skills training and CTE, we know that a post-secondary credential still has value. Students with a post-secondary credential or degree, on average, have higher earnings over the course of their lifetime than those without it. They are less likely to be susceptible or laid off during a pandemic or a recession. So providing the on-ramps, the re-engagement, the whetting of the appetite to re-enter into a post-secondary degree program through career and technical education is sort of the unique thing about this whole endeavor. So we want to present it as a both-and proposition. On the one hand, skill training and career and technical education. On the other hand, we want to incent completion in a higher education post-secondary program. We can have it both ways, in other words. It doesn't need to be an either-or proposition. And this is what we have sort of helped structure. Not only do we want to, again, encourage residents to enroll in a CTE program, but port that, articulate that, convert that into a higher and higher and higher and higher credential when the time is right, so as to, again, provide them not only economic security, but economic mobility and self-sufficiency throughout the course of their lifetime. I'm alluding to what has been thrown around now for a while is the term credential of value. That is to say, we don't want dead-end credentials or meaningless credentials or credentials that are not of high value. We want to incent enrollment in valuable credentials. And what does value mean in this context? It's a very complicated proposition. And thankfully, we have various lists that have helped us define it. On the one hand, I would immediately point to the CAPE Act and the rubric that now exists between DEO, CareerSource, and DOE in our vetting of industry certifications that not only are in demand, but can articulate into credit or accelerate an individual's time to immediate employment. We also have industry-recognized credentials in Perkins 5, as well as now, as a result of the audit from Executive Order 1931, we did an entire sort of survey, a deep dive, an analysis into the market demand of our programs, to what extent are our credentialing programs aligned to market demand, but also to what extent our programs in our public post-secondary institutions and K-12 schools, quality. Are they enrolling students? Are they retaining students? Are they completing students? Are they graduating students in a timely fashion? Are they getting jobs that are at least mid to high wage occupations, right? What are the post-completion outcomes? We now have an inventory of those credentialing programs that are theoretically valuable, at least in the department's eyes as a result of the audit. In addition to developing a list associated with the $35 million, we knew we had to develop a reliable way to incent enrollment in certain programs across the state as a result of the pandemic and as a result of the governor's $35 million set aside. So we developed a rapid credentialing list using the NACE codes, mapping that back to a SOC code, then mapping the SOC code to specific SIP codes. SOC code, standard occupational code, SIP code, classification of programs. So each program or credential has a specific identifier. Each occupation has a specific identifier. And through a crosswalking, we were able to see what we needed to incent completion in as a result of the pandemic in various regions across the state, and we developed the rapid credentialing gears list. So of this program, just for example, if I may, our highest enrollments are in emergency medical technician, automotive, phlebotomy, emergency medical technician programs, just health sciences generally, firefighter, commercial vehicle driving, nursing assistant, patient care, practical nursing, welding, as well as various supply chain logistics and other IT programs. The majority of, again, the rapid credentialing enrollments are witnessed therein. And again, this is programs, or these are programs offered across our technical centers or colleges and our Florida College System institutions. With that, I would happily sort of entertain any questions either from the previous slides, at least as it relates to technical centers and the Florida College System institution, or the topics that I quickly went through this afternoon. Many thanks.
Thank you, Chancellor Mack.
Sure.
Representative Mariano, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Chancellor, for coming and presenting today. Your presentation was great. I just had a couple questions regarding these dead-end credentials that you mentioned. Could you please give some examples of what those credentials would be and what the duration of them would be?
Sure. So maybe I could say what they are not, and by that I mean credentials that are at least not aligned to a mid-to-high-wage occupation or could not result in that eventually. A credentialing program that is not stackable or not portable or can't necessarily articulate itself into anything higher that is, again, at least able to accelerate an individual's time to economic self-sufficiency.
You're not able to give any examples. It's just hard to understand what programs we would be offering that aren't leading when they're created that aren't designed to lead to a specific.
Sure. I would be hesitant to give any example, not only because I don't have the list in front of me, but we would be able to sort of understand what wouldn't be an ideal credentialing opportunity, at least by way of the criteria that we defined in our lists, or at least according to the criteria that are identified in statute for what is a valuable credential. So if we look at CAPE, for example, we want to know mid to high wage potentiality. We want to know, is it in demand? And does it stack? Is it aligned to an industry that is of value for Florida? You know, our targeted sectors, for example, as identified in the chamber. We wouldn't want to think of a credential as valuable if it doesn't align to at least one of those industries. And insofar as it doesn't align, perhaps we would want to say, or we could conclude, that it's not worth our time, effort, or energy to sort of encourage enrollment in.
Okay, and then another follow-up.
Sure.
So for those programs that, let's say they meet the demand criteria or one of those other criteria besides the stackability criteria, what is the department doing to then make those credentials stackable or somehow, you know, creating other programs where you can have them stacked or working with the institutions that offer them to try and transition them that way?
Thankfully, the leadership is on your end in passing House Bill 7071. For example, that created the regional career pathway mandate so that for every clock hour program or credentialing program at the district level for which there is a parent AS program, there must exist an articulation agreement between the two. Lest you, for example, enroll a student in a clock hour program and they're left nowhere to go, or they're left having to repeat the time at the tech college, at the state college. So thanks to House Bill 7071, for example, that has resolved that. We moved from about 50 articulation agreements at the regional level to over 350 within 6 to 8 months of the passage of that bill. which means, to your, I think, excellent question, Representative, the department was excited by that legislation so as to allow for easier transfer of students into higher credentialing opportunities so as to not, again, sort of lead them to a dead end.
Okay, great. And if you wouldn't mind just providing the committee with what some of those dead-end credentials are, just so we have the ability to look at why they're being offered and what we can do to help streamline that moving forward, that would be great.
Sure. Happily to, and thank you for the question. And if I may, what you are doing is very, I think, progressive across the country in enshrining in statute the annual audit, the CTE audit, which has now sort of helped us to identify those programs that are not performing or those credentialing programs that are not of value. And what we are doing now is having conversations about improvement as a result.
Thank you, Vice Chair Mariano. Members, are there any other questions? You're recognized for a question, Representative Rizzo.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chancellor Mack. What energy drink or caffeine product are you on, and can I get some of it?
Sure,
right
thank
now,
you. I just love my job so much, and I love career and technical education that it comes naturally.
I can see, thank you, but I really do need a little shot of caffeine or something at this time. Chancellor, going back to your slide 12, and I want to ask you about funding, state workforce development funds. That goes to districts, you said?
Correct.
Okay, about how much is that per year, and is there a way, you said that some of it is funded by the LEA or something like that. What, can you just kind of walk me through that?
Sure, happily. So this is in the GAA. This appropriation exists for workforce education and CTE programs at the district level. Mm-hmm. On average, every year, the state allocates or appropriates about $370 million to the school districts for the support of workforce education and training programs principally offered by our technical centers or colleges across the state. Mm-hmm. This money includes not only support for CTE programs, that is to say career certificate or clock hour programs or applied technology programs, basically non-degree CTE programs. This money also goes to help support adult education.
Right.
So adult general education, basic education, high school equivalency, and English for second language learners.
Okay. So, but this is not necessarily part of, say, VOTEC funding through the FEFP?
No.
Okay.
This is a separate appropriation.
This is an addition.
Correct.
Okay.
Since FEFP is strictly K-12, we are talking post-secondary CTE programs at this point.
Right.
Non-college system.
Right. Okay. And that would go back to, Chancellor Hebb, this slide, the 90,000 plus that are in the technical.
That's correct.
Right?
That's correct.
So that $370 million, approximately per year, that is funding those 90,000, or a portion of that funding for the 90,000.
A portion of that funding for that 90,000.
Okay.
Correct. What is not here in that 90,000, if I'm not mistaken, and I can get you the correct answer on this if I am mistaken, are certain adult ed students. We're at about 120,000 when you factor that population in. That is also supported by that $370 million.
Okay, but that would be like English language learners, non-technical programs, things like that, like citizenship,
sure.
Things like that, perhaps?
Sure. We are dealing with about 1.8 million adults in the state of Florida without a high school diploma. We are dealing with a population out of about 17 million. 24% of that 17 million are barely literate, can barely do basic arithmetic. And if not for these programs, they would not have then access not only to a high school credential, but a post-secondary education. Right. And so that money also supports that population.
No, absolutely. And there's no way to really quantify like how much of the total FTE per, or per FTE, how much of that is coming from the state versus from the LEA in that situation with adult learners? Because I know that tuition has something to do with it. It's a little different than a K-12.
Certainly.
You're talking about adult ed.
So tuition and fees support CTE programs that are post-secondary in addition to our $370 million. For adult ed, however, I believe the cost of entering adult ed program is roughly $30.
Yeah, yeah. And again, I'm just asking, I know it's not necessarily your wheelhouse. That's, you know, more, you know, I guess directed to someone else, you know, but still, thank you. I'm happy
to follow up, though, because it is my responsibility. Yeah. So I'd be happy
to follow up
with the numbers.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair.
And Representative Rizzo, so you know that this does come out of our budget. So this workforce education is out of our budget, not out of the K-12 budget. So it'll be something you can see through our committee.
Thank you, sir. And I understand that. I just wanted to know, like, okay, you know, when it gets down to the district level, what's going on with that? Thank you.
Ranking Member Thompson, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation. I would imagine that an individual who is between jobs or trying to find their path may look at your occupations of high demand and decide that they're going to get a credential in one of those occupations, even though they have no real passion for that. And I'd like to know what kind of assessment you use to determine an individual's interest, aptitude, and ability.
Thank you for the question. That's a great question. Assessments of passion, aptitude, ability for an occupation they may be desiring or thinking about occurs at the local level. So it varies as a function of the school district or technical college or state college. There is no sort of statewide system in place to do that. So that will vary as a function of the district or college.
Thank you. Then my follow-up would be, and you're saying that this is individualized for different school districts, different school boards, so there's no standard. So how do you know then that a student is going to be, I guess there's going to be some sustained interest, because you can go into some kind of training, some kind of program, and if you really are not interested in it, that leads to a retention problem.
Absolutely.
And so that is the basis of my question. How do you know that you're going to retain these individuals once they get into the programs?
Thank you for the question. I think it's a great one. Evidence shows that the more that we apply learning, the better. So the more that we engage students in career exploration or conversations and apply the learning, the more likely they are to be retained and succeed and persist into post-secondary. If there's any evidence of that, I would point to the CAPE Act itself. The question is how do we know, from the state's perspective, we have, again, little engagement here, not because of lack of desire or interest. It's something that is best sort of handled at the local level with colleges' robust career advisement service programs, for example, or the career counselors and the excellent advisors that we have across the K-12 system. They are doing great work to ensure that the students' interests at least map up against potential career opportunities. The theory also, if I may, is embodied in what has become called the career pathway movement, something that Chancellor Hebda is championing at the college system level, which runs with the theory that the more choice you present students, the more paralyzed they become. So you want to sort of try and focus their attention, not limit it or restrict it so as to determine their eventual degree program, but what can we do to provide more intentional guidance? And that's called the career pathway sort of structure, where we are creating opportunities within the health sciences, for example, so that if a student wants to become a nurse, and this happens all the time, Representative, they enroll in the nursing program, but then they find out they don't like the sight of blood. And so what do they do to pivot? Well, thankfully, the career pathway structure sort of allows them to pivot into another related health science program without losing, so to speak, anything. at least by way of money or resources or time, effort, or energy. And so that would be one thing immediately from the state level's perspective that I would point to sort of help get at your question.
Thank you very much. And I'm glad to learn about the career pathways, because that was a concern. You'd have a revolving door of people going into programs and not really, you know, being excited or interested or whatever, and then you have to start all over. Can you describe for me what kind of retention or outreach is done to bring in the students that you're seeking?
Sure. I appreciate that question greatly. Please visit GetThereFL.com. GetThere, GetThereFL.com. GetThereFL.com, or the Get There Initiative, was something that the department had launched in partnership with the state to rebrand, revivify, reimagine career and technical education. And so more than just a landing page, it is a comprehensive, localized engagement effort to rethink, reimagine CTE. Very often I would submit CTE or vocational education is thought of as something other than, something lesser than traditional academics. And I think that's a harmful narrative. I think we need to elevate career and technical education as an equal option or viable option or opportunity for students, not just forcing the university pathway narrative, but introducing CTE as something that's on par with college and university life. And so the Get There campaign was principally inspired by the governor's set aside of the $35 million. What can we do to tell this story? What can we do to, dare I say, make sexy CTE and get people excited or highly caffeinated about what CTE what CTE can do? It is truly transformative. We see great transformation, wholesale transformation of individuals' lives as a result of entering a CTE program that is aligned to a high-wage or mid-to-high-wage occupation. And so the Get There campaign was our attempt to do that, at least from a statewide perspective. So common branding, common messaging, outreach and recruitment, engagement with Boys and Girls Clubs, engagement with the YMCA, engagement with the United Way, engagement with local churches and local nonprofits to penetrate communities that have historically faced barriers and entrance and opportunities into career and technical education or post-secondary education. So from a state's perspective, we saw this not only as an effort to sort of address the COVID pandemic, but to wholesale and holistically uplift lives in some zip codes across the state of Florida that I think have faced many, many barriers.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please retweet GetThereFL.com if you're so inclined.
Great. Representative. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ranking Member. And Chancellor Mack, I don't know if this relates. I think it does. And I think it might be to the benefit of the committee for you to just share it very quickly if you can. But I want to say there's a program out of Broward County that brings the instruction to communities that have been underserved and overlooked for quite some time. And I didn't know if either you or Chancellor Hebdo wanted to maybe just speak about that for a second.
If I may, I'll start and maybe pivot to Chancellor Hebda. It is Broward Up, Up standing for Unlimited Potential. So President Hale, upon his appointment as president of Broward College, launched this initiative to bring education into the community centers, into the churches, so that we can demystify the idea of attending a college. And to exactly to, I think, our conversation now, get at those individuals and residents, that I think have been sort of neglected in conversations about possible post-secondary education. I know President Hale tells the story of going around the neighborhood and encountering someone who said, "President Hale, I can't go to college. I was a convicted felon, and now I'm out. I'm not allowed to go to college." Well, that's not true. Thinking that college or certain barriers exist in the minds of certain residents within these neighborhoods is an unfortunate thing that I think we have to deconstruct so as to allow people to imagine for themselves the possibility of greatness. And sort of that's sort of what Broward Up has sort of done. Chancellor Hebda, I would defer to you for some of the particulars, if I might. Thank you for bringing it up. It's certainly a worthwhile initiative.
Thank you, Chancellor Mack. It is one of my favorite programs I've ever seen, so I'm excited to get a chance to talk about it. I was actually visiting Broward College a little over a year ago, and one of the things that they were doing that morning was signing an agreement with the local housing authority. One of the things that I alluded to in the presentation earlier is that colleges have 72 campuses and centers across the state, which makes them very localized, which is great. Even so, there are individuals that it would take them an hour, hour and a half on a bus with Uber, with something else to get to a campus. And so part of the actual statutory mission of the college system is to not just be open access, meaning we welcome everyone who comes to us, but actually reach out to individuals in our district who need post-secondary education. So the MOU with the Housing Authority was to use the building's space that wasn't being used all day and all evening to offer classes right there. And as President Hale would say, plant the flag of Broward College right there where the local citizens in that neighborhood had to trip over it to get to the grocery store, the bus stop, the whatever else they were doing there. And so then offer those credentials that would get them on the track, that would stack into something else, get them into a job, and then bring them back for more post-secondary education. I talked to one of the board members that day after the agreement was signed, and I asked her how she felt about it. She said, I'm very excited. She said, because I actually live in one of those buildings that the Housing Authority runs in one of the neighborhoods where Broward College has come to us. And she said, it has changed the conversation in that neighborhood. Nobody ever talked about going to college before, and now they do.
Thank you, Chancellor Hebda. Members, do you have any questions on that? Representative Joseph, is it about that, or is it the question you had prior? Okay, we'll go ahead and go to you now. Representative Joseph, you're recognized.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I actually just want to make a request to get with you about that program offline after this to talk about some outreach efforts. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am, sure.
Representative Joseph, did you want to ask your question, though? Because you're recognized to ask that question.
What was the question? Come back to me. I've forgotten.
Absolutely. Representative Cho, if you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor Mack, that's exciting that, as you put it, you want to make CTE sexy, so thank you for that.
Sure.
That's
I don't know if that
really,
was appropriate
really
to say in committee, but why not?
Completely appropriate.
Okay, thank you.
I just wanted to ask, though, after listening to your presentation, it's a lot of exciting stuff, but am I reading it wrong, or do you feel that everyone should have a certain level of education or a degree, or is that what you were getting at? And if so, you know, where is that level?
I appreciate the question. I could just maybe speak to what the data indicates, namely that those with a high school diploma or without do not do as well, economically speaking. Those with some college credit but no college degree also do not have the potential or as much potential as those with it over the course of their lifetime in terms of earning potential, as well as not being able to be, or rather as well as not being susceptible to economic disruption or being furloughed or unemployed or laid off as a result. So if we assume that's true, one would want to try to structure at least the education system in a way to provide for maximum choice for credentialing attainment and higher learning over the course of one's lifetime. All of that said, the ability of the education to provide opportunity, that is our responsibility. And so if with higher degrees or with higher credentialing comes more opportunity and economic self-sufficiency, or at least the likelihood of it, why would we not want to encourage as much education as possible over the course of an individual's life? It was more rhetorical, an attempt to sort of answer, I think, your excellent question, because on the one hand, we do not want to devalue the career and technical education options and credentialing programs that we have across the state. We want to elevate it. We want to enroll and incent completion in career and technical education programs that are of high value or at least aligned to an in-demand occupation across the state of Florida. And for many, that might win the day at the end. And for many, that might be it. For others, maybe not. maybe we want to sort of think about degree attainment and how we can structure CTE so as to accelerate an individual's time to degree completion, principally because of the earnings potential that may result from that degree, or principally because, God forbid, we endure another pandemic, they may not be as susceptible to unemployment or being furloughed as those without it.
Representative Schiff, do you have a follow-up? Okay.
I appreciate that response and the animation. I tell you, in my district, we have a ton of welders, electricians that we've got more jobs than people to fill them. So
yeah.
I know that I'm looking over the report, and it looks like most of those were included in the high value, I think. Those are great. I just want to make sure that I didn't misunderstand and that we're, not going to treat Floridians like customers and with the hooking and the porting and trying to meet sales goals of pushing college on everyone. When you have a lot of people that's just not what they want. But everything else sounds amazing. It sounds great. I'm really glad to watch it happen. Thank you.
Thank you for your support, too, of CTE.
And I think I just want to add one thing to this. I think it's also important to understand that with the rapidly changing technology that we have from year to year, we're looking at education now not just as something that you do, but something that is lifelong. We're talking about lifelong learners. And if we don't prepare the next generation of our workforce to understand that there is a connection between learning and workforce that is ongoing throughout your entire life and throughout your career, then we're going to put them at a disadvantage and in turn put ourselves as an economy at a disadvantage because we're not going to be able to fill many of these jobs that are constantly shifting because we have new technology every single day that's replacing the old technology that was just last month. And so we're seeing that worldwide. We have to adapt to that, both on a labor scale, but also on an education scale of how we conceptualize education and how we implant that in our students for them to understand that education is not just what they do until they graduate from college, but throughout their entire lives. And so I hope I was right on that. Representative Joseph, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So following up on Vice Chair Mariano's question about the dead end, options. I definitely wanted to make a request to see that as well. I don't know if you're providing it to the committee as a whole. So that was thing one. Thing two, with respect to the CTE, actually, let me go back. At the beginning of your presentation, you had rattled off a number of things that are in your portfolio, ending with clock hours, apprenticeship programs, and something else. And I don't remember what that something else was, but I had no idea what that was. Would you elaborate on that, please?
Sure, thank you. Thank you for the question. Happy not to provide a list of quote-unquote dead-end credentials, but happy to provide the list of those credentials or those programs that met statewide benchmarks according to our audit, as well as those credentials that met the conditions for being placed on our CAPE list. So those are the lists that I would be happy to provide, and from that, one might then infer what might not be, quote unquote, a valuable credential, at least according to the terms of the lists and the criteria that we've laid forth. Within my position as a chancellor, I oversee all of CTE for the K-12 school districts, in addition to our public post-secondary institutions at the technical colleges, in partnership with Chancellor Hebda and the Florida College System Institutions, the AS programs, but also the Office of Adult Education. Mm-hmm. Apprenticeship and articulation.
Articulation.
So, yes.
Please tell me more.
Sure. So, articulation is the Office of Articulation oversees all K-20 SUS state university system, as well as Florida College System, as well as independent colleges and universities, acceleration mechanisms. That is to say, programs or courses that can be used to accelerate an individual's time to degree completion. It also oversees all sort of articulation agreements that exist. So the 2+2 articulation agreements and whatever we may have between Florida College System institutions and state universities, those agreements sort of are housed and are administered by the Office of Articulation. Another function, for example, As a result of House Bill 7071, another great piece of legislation is the military conversion of experience or coursework for service members into credit. So if you as a military service member had coursework within your service, or if you had experience as a military member that you wanted to convert into credit, 7071 provides a mechanism now for us to do that, and we've developed a framework for how to convert your experience into course credit. We would not want to, for example, award 3 credits for a military service member who has robust experience, and I'm just making this up, in leadership skills. So if he or she is pursuing a degree in business, for example, there may be a leadership course that we would not want them or expect them to take, given their experience. So how do you convert that experience into credit? That's what articulation also is and does.
All right, last 2 questions. Sure. One tied to articulation. What, if any, issues or problems that you think us as a legislative body can address that might help you with anything you've identified with articulation, or is it all like smooth sailing and you're good to go? So that's question one. And then question two is if you, and I would extend this question to Madam Chancellor as well, if you had a policy wish list of anything that you would like this committee to consider to help with CTE or anything else in preparing our workforce with whatever their education needs might be, what would that be?
I appreciate both questions. I would have to respectfully sort of defer an answer on that and confer with our legislative budget and team and et cetera, you know, those individuals at the Department of Education to get back to you on that. If you don't mind. Okay.
Thank you, Representative Joseph. Vice Chair Mariano, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you. I'm just going to piggyback off of Representative Joseph. You came and presented using the term data and credentials, but are unwilling to provide an actual list of those credentials. Is that what I heard in her response?
Not necessarily. Thank you for the question and the follow-up. We might know what might not be valuable, at least to the core, to the criteria that we've established in the audit, as well as the CAPE Act. So we might know what is not valuable by looking at what we would consider as valuable. So we can infer what a non-valuable credential is or looks like if it's not on our credentials of value lists that we maintain at the department.
Right, so could you provide that list to us? Because if the Department of Education can't provide that list, I'm not sure who I would contact to get that list from.
Representative Joseph, if you can just speak with Vice Chair Mariano afterwards, that'd be...
Well, no, I think I can help ask the question to get to what she's trying to ask more. Because what I'm hearing from him, she's asking, what are the debt in credentials? And he's saying, well, if I give you A through F, you can figure out what's F through Z.
Sure.
And I think what we're trying to get through is what's F through Z.
So Representative Joseph, I think out of respect for Chancellor Mack, I think he's answered the question. He's going to provide you with a list. From that list, I think anyone on this committee can deduct what is not on that list, and they can assume that that is something that is not on the CAPE list and not being funded. But I think that's the most appropriate answer, and that's the answer we're going to have in this committee. Vice Chair Mariano, do you have a follow-up question? Representative Schoaf, do you have a question? Okay. Members, are there any other questions? Chancellor Mack, Chancellor Hudbeth, thank you so much for your presentation.
Thank you very much.
Members, this concludes our committee agenda. Is there any other business before the committee? Seeing none, Ranking Member Thompson moves we rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned.